And wow, a little bit nervous. That's okay though. I have tools to deal with everything. So yeah, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm here to transmit a message. I'm here to transmit a message of recovery. So, I was pretty much born and bred to be an alcoholic. Alcoholism on both sides of my family. As a little kid, my grandmother used to make these home remedies with old granddad whiskey and some other stuff when we would get sick. And so my exposure to alcohol was like out of the gate. I was getting exposed to alcohol. And I think I had a good childhood. I was an only child for the first 9 years of my life. So I was pretty much spoiled by a devoted mother. It was like, ask and you shall receive. And that's what I did. I asked for everything. And so it really primed me for the selfish, self-centered part of alcoholism. Because that's a key ingredient if you're going to use alcohol to self-destruct. You got to be selfish. You got to be able to put the blinders on and say it's only about me. So that behavior was already there, instilled in me pretty deeply. Yeah. So I learned the behaviors of alcoholism from my family before I started really having the symptom of drinking all the time. I learned the code they gave me. You know, I learned how to lie a little bit. I learned how to cheat a little bit. And I learned how to steal a little bit. So I had a good foundation for that. You know, because when you're a little kid and somebody asks you, what are you doing? And you think you're going to get in trouble, you say, nothing. Right? That's a lie. Because you were doing something. And you probably know who did it. But I never knew, and I didn't do nothing from very young. And then I learned how to cheat. There's this card game called War that little kids play. And I figured out that if I could create a distraction for my opponent, I could switch the cards real quick and be like, what? And I don't know what. So I was cheating. And then I learned how to steal, you know, the same way, because somebody, I always wanted somebody else's candy. So I would just like, you know, wait till they went to sleep and then raid their Halloween bag. Or I had all kinds of methods. So I was a prodigy with the lying, cheating, and stealing. So then as I grew, just like everybody, when you have a skill set that you practice over and over, you get better at it. And then I would say my life changed. I said for the first 9 years, I was an only child. And then when I was 9, my mother got married to my stepdad. And in that same, like within a year, had my little sister. So all that time where I was used to getting what I wanted and having all the attention, and it was suddenly changed overnight. And that kind of like made me go psycho a little bit. Because when you're used to getting what you want, and then you stop getting what you want all the time, you think it's you, you know? So at that point, I started thinking, well, something must be wrong with me, because I the mojo's gone. You know, she's like distracted by this dude that we don't even know. You know? I mean, I didn't know him. She said she knew him, but you know, after she started like switching up her behavior, she can't be trusted. You know, yeah. She's the mom, but you know, now she's like acting funny, having babies and shit. You know, you can't trust people like that. So you know, I had some misgivings, but because I was selfish and self-centered, I thought, well, it must be something. It must be something that I'm doing. You know, I got, you know, so then I start trying to escalate my lying, cheating, and stealing because, you know, you learn how to manipulate situations. And so I was trying to make things, fix, manage, and control, even from an early age, trying to fix, manage, and control the situation to cater to my preferences. And so, you know, when you do that, you meet with resistance. So that started the ism. The ism started to grow. So then in that same year, I tell you the other thing that happened. Okay, so she gets married, gets knocked up. And then we moved to California, right to Santa Maria, California. Okay. And that was a culture shock. You know, that was a culture shock. I never met any Mexicans where I lived. You know, it was like some white people, some black people, maybe a couple Asian people. You get out here and it's like, you know, the first time somebody called me a homeboy, I thought it was an insult. You know, so, you know, I got in a scuffle and but still you learn. So anyway, it's a good thing if somebody calls you homeboy, that's good. Okay, so it's true. So I had some things to learn. Meanwhile, life is in session. As it turns out, the man that my mom married, he turns out to be a heroin addict. Who knew? Right? So my life is like, you know, really upside down, because, you know, you got the dysfunction of heroin and all the behaviors, and so, you know, we're kind of getting dragged through the mud. So by the time I started high school, I had a big bag of resentments, you know, and a lot of like dysfunction, you know, and I had this constant feeling of low self-worth, you know. So what I found out in high school and middle school was that if I did something really good, I got this feedback from people that I was special and I was exceptional. And that's what I had been getting for those first 9 years of my life. After that, things changed. I didn't feel so special or exceptional. So I started playing sports, and I had some talent. I excelled. I was above average. And when I had the thrill of victory, it seemed like people wanted to be my friend, and I was popular, and I was getting this kind of this feedback that, okay, I was worthy again. Okay. So then when I started high school, that sort of continued, you know, as long as I was, and I did okay in school too. I was above average in school, and I liked that attention, you know, but I wasn't the type to, you know, when I got home, I didn't want to do homework. I want to watch cartoons or go outside and work on my jump shot, you know, stuff like that. And then when I was 15, or maybe it was 16, this neighbor kid, this is in Ventura, so we moved from Santa Maria, moved to Ventura. I go to middle school, get to high school, meet the neighbor kid. He says, hey, I got some alcohol that'll make the colors look really vivid. I like all the forms of alcohol. I like the kind of alcohol you can smoke and alcohol you can snort and the kind of alcohol that you can drop and makes... And, you know, alcohol with names like Purple Sunshine. And, you know, Purple Sunburst and shit like that. So he gives me this alcohol in the form. It was like, it looked like a postage stamp. And all of a sudden, when that alcohol affected me, that sense of specialness, I was flooded with it. I was flooded with the sense of specialness. I felt so special. Okay? And I felt so worthy of like everything. Matter of fact, I was convinced, And here's where the alcoholic delusion starts to kick in. I was convinced that I had the answer, that everybody deserved to feel this special. As special as I was feeling. That was like my first thought. I was like, everybody needs to do this. Then about 6 hours into it, I'm like, man. We need to stop. We need to stop this. I don't want to feel special anymore. But you know what? That didn't stop me from going back for more. You know, the disease had got me in full gear, and so then I started drinking on the weekends after the football games, because I was a heavy hitter on the football team. I played varsity for 3 years, and you know, it was like I was insulated. I wasn't a regular dude no more, you know. And, you know, some things started happening, some consequences started happening. I think I was a sophomore, and I got in trouble for smoking some alcohol. And, you know, I got some consequences. And, you know, the assistant principal or whatever said, you know, you're a good kid, and we want you to do good. And so they suspended me off the track team. That was my first, to me, that's like probation, you know? So I was like, I was finding the criminal lane, you know, be a lawbreaker. But that was a slap on the hand. It didn't stop me. It went on like that. Weekend parties through high school. I went to 2 years of junior college in Ventura. Same scenario, playing football, I'm popular, and the disease is progressing. Because alcoholism is progressive, and it's fatal, and it'll kill you if you don't arrest it. So it's progressing, but I'm living a double life at this point. Nobody knows, well, people know, but it's like I was so good at what I was good at that they would go, no, as long as he's good at what he's good at, don't say anything about that, you know? And I started to develop this persona of my coach told me one time, he says, you know what you are? You're a good time Charlie. And I didn't know if he was fucking talking down to me, like trying to like do an intervention. You know, like, yeah, you got a lot of talent, you could go places, but you're a good time Charlie. It's like, fuck yeah, I'm that too. You know, I thought it was like good. It wasn't good. So I went to 2 years of junior college, partied like a rock star. Then I actually transferred up to Cal Poly, and went there on like what they call a partial scholarship, which is like a lot of financial aid, like free money, you know. And I'm in I, self, and me mode, and I thought, well, you know what, I can buy a pound of alcohol and sell portions of it and like put myself through college. You know, I didn't think about like hitting the books. That would have been helpful. So anyway, I partied my way out of college. I dropped out in 1992 and went back home to Ventura, and the disease just took off. Because now I had a lot of time on my hands and a lot of using experience. I knew the moves. I knew who to approach, how to walk, how to talk, you know, so I was getting a lot of alcohol. I was getting a lot of alcohol. I was getting alcohol every day. Matter of fact, I got so much alcohol one day that I overdosed and died. That's what they told me. So this is probably the middle point of my alcoholism, where when you start to die, that's probably because you got a beginning. Okay, where you know, like the colors. Then you got the middle where you start dying. That's just the middle. And I don't know, I went through, like during that period, like in my 20s, you know how they say, people say, well, I'm a garden variety alcoholic. I was a get butt naked variety alcoholic. And there's a lot of stories where it ends with, oh, and then Gregory was naked. You know, it's like, yeah, and then he's naked. Or partially naked. And there was this one time in the middle where I was, I left the house in a pair of moccasins, okay, because they're comfortable, an orange Speedo, just an orange Speedo, and a cowboy hat. And that's what I thought. I said, it makes sense. And it would have been okay if I just walked casually down the street, but I was on the kind of alcohol that makes you like duck behind cars. And you know, so I want this alcohol in an orange Speedo, cowboy hat. There's not a lot of black guys in Ventura at this point. And so, but you know, in my mind, nobody can see me. You know, because I'm hiding. Anyway, the authorities converged. It was like, I don't know how many, maybe six police cars, and they converged. And you know, somehow I knew what to do was just to, like, sit down. Sit down on the sidewalk, take the hat off. You know, even in my, like, crazy alcoholic frenzy, I knew, sit down, you know, and then they approached me, and they asked me what my name was, and I was so blasted, man. I said, Rodney King. You know, and but one of the cops was a guy I went to high school with and played football with, so he knew I was a Rodney King, and he was like, Greg, you need to come with me, man. So he took me to mental health, and it was another slap on the wrist. I guess the people at mental health was like, oh, this is that guy who used to play football. He was in the newspapers on the sports page. Let him go. No, we don't need to treat him. You know? So they let me go. And then we did a geographical move back to South Bend, Indiana. And there's a sideline thread, and I have to mention this because it's part of my story. Like I said, I come from a family of alcoholics, and everybody's disease was progressing. My stepdad's heroin disease was progressing, and he was in and out of prison. My mom was indulging in alcohol of a certain type. With, you know, main ingredients of baking soda. And some of you will know what that is, you know, and it was devastating me, and I couldn't understand why she couldn't just drink malt liquor, smoke weed, oh, did I say weed? Smoke alcohol, and drop alcohol, like me. You know, I figured, you need to stop smoking that alcohol and do what I do. And it just wasn't happening. And I had a strong emotional connection with my mom. I still do. And so I had this plan. I was going to start smoking the kind of alcohol that she smoked and then show her how easy it was to get over it. Well, this accelerated my alcoholism. And by 1996, I think I started in 94. By 96, I was strung out on that alcohol. And I tried my first attempt at getting sober in 96 in South Bend, Indiana. And AA works Monday through Friday. But then, like, Friday at about 7:30, it stops working. Because you got to get ready to go to the club and dance and, you know, party. So it stops. I don't know why it wouldn't work, but So, and that was progress, right? Because I had it narrowed down to just the kind of alcohol that you drink. So that was my first attempt. It worked a little bit. Some things happened in South Bend. I did a geographical, came back to California. And this is about 1997. 2 years later, in 1999, I would get sober on November 7th. Oh, I just celebrated 17 years.
Yeah!
On November 7th. Yeah. Woo! 17 years. Okay, so that happened. So, from 97 to 99, I continued to drink and lived a double life. But I was only drinking, so I thought, well, you know, because I come from a heritage of functional alcoholics. And to me, that's one of those oxymorons. Because you say functional and then put alcoholic after it, it erases the first part. You know, it always tickles me when people say, well, you know, you see sharing meetings, and I say, well, you know, I was a functioning, pretty much a functioning alcoholic. You just said alcoholic after functioning. So, it, you know, it's like jumbo shrimp or military intelligence. You know, it's just, there's a discontinuity. So anyway, I thought I could be a functional alcoholic. And because I could hold a job, I could get over a hangover, go to work, pay bills, do like mainstream stuff. So I thought, well, I'm fine, you know. And then at some point between 97 and 99, my mom came from South Bend, Indiana, with her smokable alcohol, and it was like the switch got turned back on, and I was like, all right, I'm gonna show you how to quit again. Oh, man. So that, of course, accelerated things, which brings us to like October of 1999. And my disease had progressed to a point where I wasn't famous anymore. I didn't qualify for a slap on the wrist. I was just a citizen that was doing bad stuff. And so me and some homeboys, homeboys is good, okay? Me and some homeboys, one night, we're gonna go to Guadalupe, okay, to get some alcohol that people snort. And we wanted to see how fast my car could go. Okay? Because it said 120 miles an hour on the thing. And I have been drinking all day, and when I drink, two things happen. I get naked. And I get courageous. And, you know, I was a daredevil all my life, you know, because even when I was a little kid, we played follow the leader. And I wouldn't back down from a challenge. You gonna jump off the roof? I'm gonna jump off the roof. Yeah, but you're only 4 feet tall. I don't care. You know, I want to run with the big boys because I always had something to prove, right? Because I felt less than, you know. So I was always, you know, trying to prove something. So, yeah, the homeboys, yeah, I still had that part of my ism. So I'm flooring it. It's a Volkswagen Jetta. Front wheel drive. German technology, man. You can't beat it. So we're on 166 going to Guadalupe. And the car and the front end starts bouncing because we hit like 90, right? And there's this CHP eastbound on the other side. I didn't know this at the time until we passed them, and I looked and I saw, you know, cherries and blueberries in the police lights. Okay. Yeah, it was a CHP. So CHP, you know, turns a U-turn, comes get us, And somehow in my mind, I thought, well, by the time they catch up, we will have, like, slowed down to 55. It'll be all right. It wasn't. It was not all right. They did what they do. Started that process of get out of the car and put these bracelets on and now get in this other car and come with us. And, you know, in all the excitement, I had forgotten to pee. And, you know, before they put me in the car, I was, you know, still in daredevil mode. And I was like, I know my rights and, you know, impressing the homeboys. So you turn that off, please, or answer it. Maybe it's for me. I don't know what's going on. Anyway, so he's a friend of mine. I know him. I'm just messing with him. So they put me in the back of a police car, and I said, "Well, can you let me out to pee?" And he said, "No, feel free to pee on yourself." So I did. But the next one, I had forgotten all this. You know, until years later, and they put me in the drunk tank out there on Foster Road, and you know, when I passed out, I was the only one in the thing. But when I wake up, there's these three homeboys in the opposite corner, and we're all like eyeing each other up, and I'm thinking, which one of these guys peed on me? You know, yeah, which one of these guys peed on me? So. As a result of that, I get a nudge from the judge. I go to Santa Barbara County, which has a great view of the beach, okay, if you're on the farm, which is, as I was told, the good part of the jail, okay? So that's who I am. I go to the good part of the jail. But it's like functioning alcoholic, good part jail. There's a discontinuity. I spent a total of 17 days behind bars, got a nudge from the judge, fines, restitutions, debt to society, court card. So I was reintroduced to Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous right in this very room, came to some of my first meetings. I was desperate not to go back to jail. I didn't know about... not drinking, because I still had some ideas that it wasn't the alcohol, that it was the people I was drinking with. And that if I could just drink by myself, you know, with no homeboys, no, like, people challenging me, then I would be fine. You know, I had that lingering thought. But as I began to come around Alcoholics Anonymous more, I was intrigued by what was going on here. I was intrigued and suspicious, and I was doubtful that this was true. I had had an uncle who had gotten sober and, like, managed to stay sober. So I guess I believe that he was still batshit crazy, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was like, I don't know. And then I came here, and people said they were sober, but they were still batshit crazy. And I was like, and let me tell you, I have no room to judge batshit crazy. Because when I came here, and some people will tell you, I used to wear glass frames, just frames. No lenses. And I would tell some of the female members that they were X-ray vision. And do stuff like that. And I would wear pajamas to meetings. This is before pajamas were fashionable. I was doing this in the late 90s. Okay, so any of you that think you made it up, it was me. So I was pretty sick and twisted. But I had the gift of desperation. And out of the gift of desperation grew a small amount of willingness. A willingness at least to not go back to jail. Okay? With that, and then two, it was like I wanted to be better than the other newcomers. That's part of my ism, you know. Because people were faking their court cards and shit. I was going to Central Coast Headways, and I would hear them talk about, yeah, man, I don't go to those meetings. And I was like, I'm going to fucking be better than you, you know. So I would really go and get mine signed, and it made me feel like, you know, because I like to feel special. That's my whole thing. That's the whole reason why I did everything, because I want to feel special. And so I did it legit. I stayed sober 30, 90, 60 days, you know, or... Yeah, 30, 60, 90, yeah, somehow, yeah. And I was determined to get a year, you know, because how I was showing up to the rooms, there was this little scuttlebutt that I wasn't going to make it. And people were taking bets. And when my sponsor at the time gave me my one year chip, he like, handed it to me, shook my hand, pulled me in, and he goes, I didn't think you were gonna fucking make it. What? I was crushed. It's fucking Daryl. Okay? Yeah. So yeah, he was my first sponsor. He took me through my first cycle of steps, helped me get that first 365 days, and I haven't stopped since then. Because I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous for what it does for me. Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to completely evolve. Because when I got here, I was spiritually unfit. I was socially unfit. I was physically unfit. You know, I was just unfit all the way around. And by continuing to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and do what is suggested, okay, get a sponsor. Get the literature. Read the literature. You know, allow my willingness to become faith. You know, faith in this process. Because, and then too, the spiritual aspect of it appealed to me after my head started clearing. Because I had enough of religion. I already had a religion when I got here, and it didn't work. You know, and for me, there was too many holes in my religion that I inherited, you know. Stuff just didn't make sense to me. Why do I have to wait till I'm dead to get the good stuff, right? I never could wrap my head around that. I get to Alcoholics Anonymous and they said, well, we got some promises that you can get if you keep the plug in the jug and do the program as it's prescribed. And that's what I needed. I needed immediate relief from myself, from my ism, because it was so severe. I needed I can't wait till I'm dead to get relief from this, because I tend to try to kill myself. Right. You know? If you say, well, when you get dead, you can, well, shit, let's get it on with the dead. Let's get to killing ourselves, you know. But Alcoholics Anonymous said, no, we want you to stay alive and get some stuff while you're alive. But here's what you got to do, you know. And there's a bunch of musts. I think it's like 50-something musts in the book, in 57 musts, right? In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And must is a very specific word. It means you really, really, really have to, okay, or else. Do this or you don't get that. So I did the must. I continue to do the must. I apply the steps in my daily life. I need that, you know. I need this spiritual program because I need something I can verify in my own life. I'm not the type of person that can read about somebody else's life that lived thousands of years ago and be like, okay, I'll do that. No, this book, I don't know, Alcoholics Anonymous is probably, what, like 80-something years old, 83 years old. So with a little footwork, I could verify that all of these people lived. You know, there's public records. I could go find Bill Wilson's birth certificate. Yeah, he lived. And then I could probably even, like, find other things to support the fact that he lived and actually did this. And if that's not enough, I'm alive and I actually did this. Right. Came back from the brink of death, okay? And it's Alcoholics Anonymous isn't it's not an invention. It's a discovery. Because human beings, we don't invent shit. If somebody tells you they invented something, that's bullshit. They discovered something. You know, a guy had a piece of stone that was a little rounder than the other stones, and like kind of dropped it and it rolled, and he was like, ooh. Ooh. You know. But then you got another guy that never did anything, but he's like got all these ideas. They're called marketers, right? The marketing guy, and he's gonna want like 35% of whatever. So he comes along and goes, ooh, ooh, ooh. And other guy's like, ooh, ooh. He's like, ooh, 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 ooh. Right? You're gonna tell all the other people, look, we made this happen. No, nobody makes anything happen, okay? God makes everything and we discover it. So Bob and Bill discovered this process. They didn't invent it, they discovered it and presented it to people like themselves as a tool, okay, for survival of a deadly disease, right? That's what we do. We discover things and then we share. So nobody can take credit for this. You know, this is a discovery, a method, a tool used to save lives, okay? And that's the damn truth, okay? So if you're in this room tonight, you qualify to inherit the tools, okay? These life-saving tools, this life-saving process, okay? That if you apply it to your own life, okay, the way that it's prescribed, you will get to a point where you will be so grateful that you'll want to help others discover it. You know, this is a sponsor-making machine of sorts. That's what it's designed to do. It's designed to take a piece of shit like me, put me through the ringer, okay, and then come out still a turd, but like kind of shiny. You know? And what ends up happening is, a less shiny turd comes through the door and goes, "Yeah, that turd's kind of shiny. What?" And he comes up to you and goes, "Hey, man, you're shining. Well, how'd you do that?" You go, "Well, it's 57 months in this book on how to shine up a piece of shit." You know? And then what happens is, okay, you got to understand, Alcoholics Anonymous was discovered in a time in America, okay, in the 30s, when apprenticeship was a strong cornerstone of American society, okay? And apprenticeship, if you don't know, I'll just quickly lay it out for you. What happens is somebody who's masterful at a certain skill set takes somebody, okay, let's say, okay, a piece of shit that's masterful at a skill set of like how to make themselves shiny, takes a dull piece of shit and says, "Come over here, I'm gonna show you the boogie," right? And then they give them the tools and say, "Well, yeah, we'll slow down. We're gonna give you three tools right off the top. Honesty, open-mindedness, willingness." Okay, so that's what you get, and you start trying to, you know, confront life with your simple tool set, you know? And then you go back to your, what is it, you call him a journeyman. Okay, so you got a journeyman who's masterful with the skill set, with the honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, and the 12 steps. And so they're going to show me. I have Leo's my journeyman. He's my sponsor. Leo's the journeyman. I'm the apprentice. So Leo's not a master because there's no masters in Alcoholics Anonymous, but he's masterful, okay? Now, if you break down the word, that means he's full of the master. Okay, he's full of mastery. Okay, and I can attest to that because Leo's always hammering the book. You see Leo, and he doesn't have his little book bag with him. I'll be finished with you in a minute. He doesn't have his little book bag with him, and he's all like kind of, I got to give him a hug, you know, to like level him up. Because he's like, so Leo's a journeyman, I'm the apprentice. He takes me through, and at some point, he says, "All right, you're kind of masterful. I want you to go and make yourself available to some dull pieces of shit." Okay? And so that's what I do. You know? And then one day somebody like Frank approaches me and says, "Hey, you are kind of a shiny piece of shit. I want you to show me how I get shiny like you. And I do. And then Frank gets shiny. Another piece of shit, Pro Frank. Okay, and it goes on. This is an apprenticeship program. It's rooted in that tradition. Okay? And if you stay and follow the direction of the journeyman, you will become a journeyman. You will become masterful. You will receive your inheritance. You will receive the promises that Alcoholics Anonymous extends to every piece of shit that comes along. Okay? And they told me when I came here that I should make an effort to become saturated with the principles. Saturated with the principles. Okay? And what happens when a sponge gets saturated? When you squeeze it, whatever it's saturated with is what's going to come out. Now, if I'm saturated with lying, cheating, and stealing, okay, when I'm confronted by life, I'm nothing. I don't know. Look over there. Swipe. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to lie, cheat, and steal. But if I'm saturated with honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, okay, and I smash those things together and I start to forge integrity, and from that integrity I start to acquire social credibility, okay, and that's some valuable shit, okay, social credibility. I'm not talking about the credit that the bank gives you, because they can take that away, but social credibility I'm responsible for, and what that means is my word is my bond. When I say I'm going to be somewhere, I show up there. You know, I show up there, I do my best, I'm honest. If I'm in over my head, I say, wait, I'm in over my head. That happened to me recently. You know, I was a bus driver. I quit the bus driver job to go up to Paso Robles to become, in my mind, the head of the welding department. Right? But it's only three guys in the shop. There is no department. I'm the welder. That's it. But in my mind, I'm the head of, right? So I go up there. Things don't work out. I get fired. No, I quit. I got, you know how alcohol is. I either quit or I got fired. I don't give up. I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened. Anyway, it happened. But because I followed the direction of a journeyman, because I've internalized this process and the tools that I need to meet life on life's terms, I went in. And I'm saturated. When I got squeezed by life, what came out? Call Leo Mill. Leo, you got a minute? And see, Leo trained me to do that. He said, look, whenever you call me, you ask me if I got a minute. Right? And that's respect. And I pass that along to, like, you know, to the guys I sponsor. And so I go, Leo, I'm like spastic. You got a minute? And I was like, yeah. So I lay it out for Leo. And Leo tells me the prescription. You know, he reminds me of what I already know. He says, all right, what are you going to, first he asked me, what are you going to do? Right? He wants to know what I'm going to do, because I might be getting ready to do something crazy. I'm going to burn these motherfuckers down. Right? So he wants to know if he's got to talk me off the ledge. But I'm not on the ledge, okay? So then the direction is much simpler. He's like, okay, pray about it. We're going to pray right now. We pray over the phone. He says, all right, God, help Gregory find the job that's going to work for him, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So that happens. I go to a meeting. The stuff that's in me comes out. Call Leo. Pray. Go to a meeting. This is a recipe for success, because the disease is like, the I self in me is like lying. It's like, you're better than that. No, I wasn't. I was not qualified to do what they wanted me to do. And things came to a head and I had to be humble and admit that. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, these principles allow me to be clear. See? And when I'm clear, the fear dial gets turned way down. You know? And I'm not afraid to be me. You know? I'm not afraid to, maybe not proudly, but if somebody asks me, like, what's your deal? Well, I'm just a shiny piece of shit. That's what's up. You know? And I have a higher power. I'm a shiny piece of shit with a higher power. Ooh, jump back. That is like potent, okay? So, I'll tell you how God works. Because I have social credibility. Because I have integrity, okay? In a matter of 4 days, I had two job offers. Because Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to become a productive member of society who has integrity and can go to an employer and say, look, I just got shit canned, okay? But this is what I can do for you, you know? And it's the truth, see? So now I'm employed in a... Oh, man, it's crazy. The details... That job was going to pay me $17 an hour. That's why I jumped ship from SMAT. I was like, shit, $13, $17. I can do math. I'm going to do the $17 job, right? So I go up there. I fail. Days later, I get a job offer that's going to pay me $15 an hour. As many hours as I want. So ultimately, it's going to be more money than the $17 job that was for 40 hours. Right? Because God's, I was, because Leo said, pray for God's will. I was like, oh, God, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? So I pray for God's will. God's like, I want you paid, man. I'm going to give you a job where you get as many hours as you want. Now, the money's going to be less. But you know what? They're going to pay for your medical benefits. They wasn't doing that at the $17 hour job. They're going to put you on the group dental plan in 30 days. No, day one. Okay, because that's what God wants me to have. Okay, not only that, when I went up to that job at Pass Roads, I was the head of welding. It woke something up in me, and I realized that I really like the welding. I like building shit. I like that instant gratification. I want to be the metal, and I'm like, that shit stick. It's gonna outlive me. I like that, right? Because I like to feel special. So here's what happened. I get this job that's better than the one that I got fired from, and at the same time, a little voice says, why don't you go check in with the Steam Fitters Union? Okay. Well, I go and check in with the Steam Fitters Union, put in an application. And from day one, when I put that application in, they're like, yeah, you can come here 5 days a week and use our welding bay. So now my welding skills are going to get up, right? So now I get to do both things. Get paid, still do what I like, welding, okay? And potentially qualify for an apprenticeship, there's that fucking word again, right? with a journeyman steam fitter. And some of you know the kind of money that steam fitters make, but I'll tell you what, when I was talking to the dude, I got so excited. He was like, yeah, it's the local in San Luis. And he says, yeah, our guys are suitcase, they call them suitcase journeymen. He says, yeah, our guys are making between $250 and $500. And I'm thinking, yeah, $250 a week, I could, you know, deal with $500 a week. And I said, wait, do you mean with 000? He was like, yeah. I was like, okay. Where's that application? So this is the kind of potential that God has placed in my life. Okay? When I surrender to this process and I surrender to God's will for me. Okay? And do the next right thing. With some time and some attention and some surrender, I've gotten well, okay? I'm still sick because the disease doesn't go away. It's progressive, it's fatal, it's incurable, okay? So I have to treat it on a daily basis. Just like, but the disease is so treatable. It's so treatable that, like, sometimes normal people think I'm fucking normal, okay? That's how treatable it is. I tell you what, it gets so good, sometimes they don't even notice I'm black. Alcoholics Anonymous is some potent shit, I'm telling you. Okay? Yeah, it's dynamite. So, I really love Alcoholics Anonymous. That's just a little slice, man, but you know what? Out of respect for time and, you know, whatever, football season, I'm going to you know, I'm going to write some shit, right? And like, because they say you can't transmit what you haven't gotten. I always get up here and I forget to transmit some shit. So I wrote some shit down. But I think I covered it all. You know, it's weird. Just having it here. Let's see. Clarity arrives, fear dissipates, we can see brightness on the horizon. I wrote that shit, I was like, yeah, they're gonna eat this place. And you know, I just imagine Bill Wilson writing the Big Book. When he was like, yes, I'm a paragon of You know, you read some of this, read the big book and you see what I'm talking about. Anyway, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It works when you work it. I love all you pieces of shit. Okay? I love you all. So join us in the happy road of destiny. And that's it. Okay.